Well, we have been journeying through the New Testament together, and we've made it through the book of Acts, and today we're starting a new book, the book of Romans. And interestingly enough, as we talk with Petula about, about Petula and her service in Bosnia, that is exactly the work that Paul is doing as he is moving around the Mediterranean basin, what we now refer to as Europe, where Paul is going from place to place, sharing the gospel. And in this book of Romans, Paul has not been able to make it there yet. And so when Paul was unable to make it to a certain area, of the world, he would write a letter. And Romans is this letter. He's not yet been there, but he's writing a letter encouraging them and stimulating them on in their faith. Which reminds me of a story. I saw this a couple of weeks ago, but on June 26th, 2007, Major Gregory Young was doing a naval exercise off the coast of Oregon. And in the midst of this training exercise, he was flying his F-15A, and in the middle of this exercise, he flew his $32 million aircraft into the Pacific Ocean. There was no distress call, there was no attempt to eject, and there was no apparent aircraft malfunction. Young, who was 34, had 3,200 hours of flight time that he had worked on, and 750 hours of that was in F-15s. As investigators sifted through the wreckage, they were trying to determine what was the cause of this tragic accident. What caused this F-15 to travel 600 miles an hour straight into the ocean, obliterating the plane and killing Major Young? The answer was revealed in an investigative report about 2 months later. The cause of the accident was described as this: inexperienced, unrecognized spatial disorientation, which caused him to misperceive his altitude and airspeed. And as a result, he was clearly unaware of his position and impact of the water. In other words, Young never knew what hit him. Despite training and experience and technology, all based on the knowledge of how flights affect human physiology, Young had no idea that he was racing downward. Once called pilot's vertigo or aviator's vertigo, spatial disorientation is a persistent killer. The FAA statistics show that the condition is partly responsible for 15% of all aviation accidents. And as you can imagine, 90% of those accidents are fatal. According to a 2004 study, the average life expectancy of a non-instrument-rated pilot who flies into the clouds or instrument conditions is 178 seconds. 2 minutes, 58 seconds. The key is in the instruments. See, pilots are trained when in instrument conditions, that being dark, fog, to read their instruments instead of trusting their senses, what they see out the windows. And so, as I said, pilots are given a special training in order to remember that though their senses were telling them one thing, that they must rely on their instrument panel. And as you can see, even the most trained of pilots fall into the problem of trusting their senses over their instruments. Paul, as he writes this letter to the church in Rome, has a similar warning. See, the theme of the message this morning is by faith or by feel. And biblical faith in a holy God tells us to trust in Him, to trust in faith, to trust in what He tells us to do instead of what our senses tell us about ourselves. You see, Paul had been from village to village leading people to Jesus, and he's longing to go to this greatest city of influence. But since he can't make it, he writes them a letter, and he writes them a letter about faith and what faith means. He talks about what God does when we come into a life-changing relationship with Him, and that we as His followers must place our faith in those changes, in what God says about us, instead of how we feel about ourselves. If you would, turn with me to Romans chapter 1, verse 16 and 17. If you don't have a Bible, you can get one in your hands, and if not, we have the verses up here to my right and to my left. Romans 1, verse 16. For I am not ashamed of this good news about Christ. It is the power of God at work, saving everyone who believes, the Jew first and also the Gentile. This good news tells us how God makes us right in his sight. This is accomplished from start to finish by faith. And as the scriptures say, it is through faith that a righteous person has life. You see, for thousands of years, we've talked about this before, people have tried to attain their own means of salvation. They've tried to work for it themselves. The focus was on them. And the Bible tells us that a holy God can't allow imperfection or sin into his presence. And so for centuries, Jewish people have sacrificed animals and other offerings to appease the anger of God. What Paul discovered in Acts 9 in his collision with Jesus on the road to Damascus is that God longs for us to be reconciled to him. The mystery and majesty of God's salvation is revolutionary, and Paul's on a mission to spread the news. The message, if you look in verse 16 there, it's referred to as the gospel or good news. God takes an imperfect, broken, and fallen person and restores them from the inside out. You see, instead of us doing the work, it's God that does the work. The focus is on God. Our only contribution, says this verse, is faith. We place our faith in what God does in our behalf. Paul writes that the righteous person has life by expressing that faith. They live in that faith. And the faith that Paul is writing about is placed on the finished work of the cross. But what does that really mean? Paul in chapters 1 and 2 lays out for us three different things that we need to look at this morning on what God does in and through our lives. And he does that as he writes this letter to the church in Rome. He says that living by faith is the way we are to live, trusting in the instrument panel of God. Faith gives us power to live righteously the way God intends us to live. And the other way to live is by feel. And in that world, feelings are reliable. Feelings are what's most important. Feelings rule the day. You've heard the expression, if it feels good, do it. When you live by feel, you insist on living in your own power, on your own terms. And this way flies in the face of living by faith. It demonstrates that we can trust ourselves over God, and it leads to destruction of ourselves, of others, of everyone. And so, as I said, we're going to look at three effects of our rebellion against God and three things God does to counteract these tendencies in us when we turn to him. We'll look at how he uses them in our instrument panel of life. And the way we're going to look at these three things, we're going to look at three different questions this morning. And that first question is found in verse 18. The question is this: who is the center of the universe? Who is the center of the universe? Look at verse 18. God shows his anger from heaven against all sinful, wicked people who suppress the truth by their wickedness. They know the truth about God because he has made it obvious to them. For ever since the world was created, people have seen the earth and sky. Through everything God made, they can clearly see his invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature. So they have no excuse for not knowing God. Yes, they knew God, but they would not worship him as God or even give him thanks. And they began to think up foolish ideas of what God was like. And as a result, their minds became dark and confused. Claiming to be wise, they instead became utter fools. And instead of worshiping the glorious, ever-living God, they worshiped idols made to look like mere people and birds and animals and reptiles. You see, the answer to the question, who is the center of the universe, if you're living by feel, is you. You're the center of the universe. Everything exists for your benefit and your pleasure. When you begin to observe the world and it screams out, like this passage says, that there's a creator, You have to take action. When looking at the sky and the things of the earth, the person must suppress, as this passage says, suppress the natural inclination to worship. I imagine they'd have a very difficult time not worshiping, especially if they're in the midst of a field or a meadow or a woods, or if you're like me, by the ocean, where it just screams out that there's a God. But this passage tells us they have to suppress that. Why worship, you say? Well, look at verse 20. It says, through everything God made, they can clearly see his invisible qualities, his eternal power, his divine nature. Paul is saying this: when someone sees the world for what it really is, they see God's invisible qualities, like wisdom and love, his eternal power, and his divine nature, like holiness and omnipotence. Paul says that ungodly people suppress those truths in their wickedness. It sounds harsh, doesn't it? All this means is they refuse to believe what is true. If you are the center of the universe, you can't have any competition. If you want to remain the center of the universe, you have to suppress the truth. You have to get rid of the evidence. The only natural conclusion to this way of living is to act as if God does not exist. But as I said before, this is a conclusion with devastating consequences. Now, with God in the picture, a person designed to worship, or excuse me, now without God in the picture, a person designed to worship must find something else to worship. They begin to devise in their own minds what God must be like. And if you look at the next few passages, few verses, 21 through 23, you have to find out a different way to worship. And as a result, it tells us their minds became dark and confused. Have you ever tried to find your way around a room with the lights off? Think that's exactly, spiritually speaking, what it's like for these people to try to find their way to God. See, people who are the center of their own universe have only themselves to guide them. And without a spiritual GPS system that only God can provide, people are left to turn down street after street after street, each one being a dead end. And after a while, this passage tells us that people will worship just about anything. Without God to fill their hearts and minds, people, birds, and animals look pretty good as idols. And when you are the center of the universe, you can choose who is a god, even if it's you. Paul knew what that was like. He was the center of his own universe too. Remember on the road to Damascus, he was a pretty high hog in the hierarchy there of the Jewish leadership. And the passage tells us in Acts 9 that one day on the road to Damascus, Jesus had his way with Paul. He messed up his life, so to speak, for good. He knocked Paul right off the throne of his own life. And when we, like Paul, recognize that we are not the center of the universe and that God is, we confess with our mouths that he is God. And we repent of our self-centeredness. We demote ourselves in the solar system of our own world just to become a planet revolving around the center of this new universe, that being God. The Bible tells us what God does in salvation for us. And the first word, it's a churchy word, it's called justification. And that simply means being set right with God. You see, we have this sin in our lives, this thing that separates us from God. And when God justifies us, when we turn to God and confess him as Savior, God declares us innocent. He wipes the slate clean. He justifies us. In other words, Paul says when we do this, we're made right with God. Because Jesus already paid the ultimate penalty for sin, namely death on a cross, we simply just ask God to have Jesus cover the payment for us too. So God justifies us, or makes us right with him. You see, he loves his son Jesus. And when Jesus comes into our lives, he sees Jesus in us, and he loves us as well. And so now that you're living by faith, God becomes the center of the universe. In other words, God comes first. All of reality is defined by God. All things in the universe have their explanation because of God. And when God is the center of the universe, he's also the center of your personal universe. And what I mean by that, you've heard me say this before, living by faith means that God gets to define reality for you. And so if God says that you're forgiven, even though you don't feel forgiven, or you're beating yourself up for something you did, God says you're forgiven. So biblical faith, God being in the center of the universe, says that I'm forgiven. Or if you're having a difficult time loving someone else because they seem unlovable and God's saying to love them, God is the center of the universe, not you. And so we trust God and we trust him for the power to extend love and forgiveness to people who are unlovable and unforgivable because God is the center of the universe. On October 28, 1950, a man by the name of Oscar Collazo and an associate made a decision. And their decision was this. They decided to assassinate President Harry Truman. You see, Collazo and his associate were connected with a group of Puerto Ricans who were trying to make Puerto Rican independent. And because there wasn't a lot of world recognition about this, they decided that to kill President Truman would bring more attention to their cause. And so they found out that during this period of time that the White House was closed for renovation and President Truman was staying in a hotel close by Washington, D.C., where he usually is. And so Collazo and his associate snuck into the hotel and began to approach the president, and his men came out and there was a crossfire. And several men were killed, but President Truman avoided being assassinated by Collazo and his associate. Well, as you can imagine, Collazo, after he and his partner had killed several of Truman's entourage and Secret Service men, that he was sentenced to death. Every year, or at the end of every presidential term, presidents are allowed to pardon people for crimes done against them. And it's been historical. Presidents for hundreds of years have pardoned people. In other words, declared them innocent, though they were deserving of the punishment of their crime. And when Truman's turn to pardon, though Collazo was sentenced to death, and it was Truman's life that was on the line, President Truman pardoned Oscar Collazo. See, that's what God does in us. Collazo was guilty. He deserved what he was getting. And President Truman stepped in and saved his life. Friends, because of the sin in our lives, we deserve what's coming to us. And so what God does, what justification means, is that Jesus steps in and he declares us innocent, not guilty. Right relationship with God. Which leads me to the second question in this text this morning is, what is the goal of relationships? What is the goal of relationships? Verse 28, since they thought it foolish to acknowledge God, he abandoned them to their foolish thinking and let them do things that should never be done. Their lives became full of every kind of wickedness, sin, greed, hate, envy, murder, quarreling, deception, malicious behavior, and gossip. They are backstabbers, haters of God, insolent, proud, and boastful. They invent new ways of sinning, and they disobey their parents. They refuse to understand, break their promises, are heartless, and have no mercy. They know God's justice requires that those who do these things deserve to die, yet they do them anyway. Worse yet, they encourage others to do them too. You see, if you are living by feel, all relationships are for your benefit, for your pleasure. In other words, relationships exist to benefit you. If you notice, everything that Paul discusses in these verses have a relational bent to them. They're all interrelational things. Wickedness, malicious behavior, deception, gossip. These things can't happen outside of a relationship. Why? Because we're relational people. God is a relational God. And without relationships, we die. And when we become the center of the universe, we decide how relationships work. And left to our own devices, we will make choices to benefit ourselves. We hate, we envy, we quarrel, we deceive, we gossip, and we murder. We're boastful and proud. And when we try to define morality without God, it's impossible. We don't keep promises, we're heartless, and we show no mercy. Why keep promises if nobody says we have to? Why show mercy? You may have noticed that I skipped over a pretty generous section of Romans 1. And that part deals with homosexuality. And I skipped over it for a reason. Do I think homosexuality goes against God's natural design for people? I do. But it's distracting because there's so much to be said there, and it's very political. But I think we miss the point if we don't address this in entirety. You see, from that part on, all of these things deal with relationship. And if we elevate the way we are, if we elevate homosexuality, then we forget about envy and greed and gossip. I think it was Paul's intention and God's intention to put them together. The major point here is that relationships are created by God. He existed eternally in a relationship with himself. He's the one that designed how relationships ought to work, not just man with woman as far as marriage, but people to people, relating and caring and loving one another. And anytime we try to dictate the terms of how relationships are supposed to be outside of the parameters that a holy and righteous God sets for us, we will destroy ourselves. But if we're living by faith as God's followers, we get to receive the second incredible gift of salvation, and that's called sanctification. So we have justification, being set right with God, and we have sanctification, and that's simply this. It's the process by which God takes a sinful person and conforms him to the image of Jesus, cleansing him, renewing their mind, giving them new motivation, giving them new desires to follow after God. And as we live in God, the Spirit of God brings to our attention things in us that are sinful and hurtful to him. And we confess them and ask God to change us, and God changes us. When God dictates the term of our relationships, we submit to his wishes. We love, not hate. We encourage, not envy. We tell the truth. We keep the confidence of others. We are humble because we're not the center of the universe. We show mercy because it was shown to us. Most of us are familiar with Charles Dickens, right? And his books, and his most famous character is probably Ebenezer Scrooge, right? Ebenezer Scrooge. Greg, why are you talking about Ebenezer Scrooge in July? Well, you've heard Christmas in July, right? If retail stores can do it, can't pastors do it also? So Ebenezer Scrooge, right? We all know the story. He was a wicked, corrupt, selfish, greedy old man. And everything he did was for his own benefit. Even to work Bob Cratchit and other workers tooth and nail so that they would make a profit for him. And when holidays came up, it was time to give employees a little bit of a vacation, a little time off. Even on Christmas Eve, Bob Cratchit still has to work on Christmas Eve, even though he wants to be home with his family and little tiny Tim. Well, as the story goes, the ghosts of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future show up. And they begin to show Ebenezer Scrooge all about his life, what his life used to look like, what his life looks like now, and what his life will look like if he goes down this same path. You see, Ebenezer Scrooge was given a great gift to take a look at that. Many of us don't get that opportunity. But Scrooge began to see the grace that was being extended to him, and he was undone. And he changed his ways, as the story goes. He loved his people. He became one of the most generous and kind-hearted people that ever lived. Because he was given grace, he changed. He no longer wanted the glory. He would give it up to others. You see, in the process of sanctification, God takes us right where we are. And if we're all willing to admit it, there's a little bit of selfishness, a little bit of greed, a little bit of anger, all those things in our hearts. And though God initially declares us right before his eyes, he also wants to do a work in us. He wants to change our desires. He wants to change our hearts so they might look after him. And now we'll look at the last question that this passage answers, and that is, what is the ultimate destiny for people? Romans 2, verse 5 says this, but because you are stubborn and refuse to turn from your sin, you are storing up terrible punishment for yourself. For a day of anger is coming when God's righteous judgment will be revealed. I read recently that in eternity, everybody gets what they want. Think about that for a second.